What is up, everyone? This is your good friend Patrick O'Dowd, joined as always by his mutual good friend, the lawyer David Ungar. Yours and our mutual friends. We all love Dave. Dave's a good dude. 900-year-old lawyer who sort of answers our questions when we have legal ones, even when it's not in his realm of study and field. And all of that is irrelevant today because we're not going to talk about any legalese stuff here on this week's edition of the Four Corners Podcast. And what a week it was in sports. The St. Louis Blues are trash, absolute trash. I don't understand it. There seems to be a distinct lack of toughness in my St. Louis Blues, which is why I haven't been too keen to talk about hockey, and I'm still not. I'm not feeling it. It makes me sad. What we are going to talk about today is we are, of course, going to talk about the World Series, a Game 7 classic, instant classic Game 7, though I have some feelings about it and some stats and numbers. We are going to talk college football because yet another coach, as we record this podcast, could be on his way out. As that news was breaking and I sent it to Dave while we were setting up the studio, Dave is nodding in affirmation that he saw it. And college basketball starts this week. That's right. The NBA has already kicked off. College basketball starts games on Monday. And some good, not some good stuff. I will not say good stuff because, for example, the University of Illinois is kicking off its season, taking on Jacksonville State. And while I have much respect for the Ohio Valley Conference, I don't know if Jacksonville State is going to tell me anything about the University of Illinois. Now, there are some better marquee matchups that move along as you get further into November. Of course, all the big-time programs are just warming up. But before we get into any of that at all, we got to check in on our boy Dave. Dave, one, how are you? Welcome back. And I noticed your coffee mug as you lifted it up. Your Mickey Mouse coffee mug. I have almost purchased that mug at a Disney park. I do, however, and I'm not using it today. My favorite coffee mug is my favorite villain of all time in the history of Disney animation. That is Maleficent. I have a beautiful sketchbook Maleficent mug that is usually in the weekend rotation. She's in the wash today, so we get the coffee mug I use to reheat the pot after it shuts off.
Plain white coffee mug. It does the job. It gets the job done.
It's what middle-aged men do.
That's true. Obviously, this is my wife's purchase, not mine, because she's the one with all the taste in the family. It's a remembrance of better times for Disney, because I think we might be a little bit harsh on Disney later on this afternoon. But that's for another show, for another
Disney,
time.
Disney as a studio, not Disney as a theme park. I mean, we can be mad at Disney, but I actually think the Disney theme park game has been upping itself lately, and I'm not afraid to talk about that here, because I think that they're Josh D'Amaro, who seems to be on the inside track to overtake or to replace Bob Iger when he finally does step down. And Bob, please step down. Move on. So let's get this done. But it's looking like more and more like Josh D'Amaro might be the presumed successor to Bob Iger. And he is a parks guy. And a lot of stuff is happening on the Disney World Resort side of things that seem to be reflective of seeing what Universal is doing. Mostly Universal Studios Florida, not so much Hollywood, but, you know, with the opening of the new Universal Park, Orlando becoming increasingly competitive as a vacation destination, and those parks being the places that people go, no matter how much people bitch about the cost of going to a Disney World or Universal Resort, they're still going in significant numbers, and prices are not going down, they're just going up, but people are still going. People like me. I'm a full-on Disney adult and not ashamed to admit it.
I've got to start planning my the December trip. We're now officially in November, so it's time to start thinking about the annual holiday trip. I think the 70th anniversary of Disneyland goes into effect November 14th.
I mean, the merchant stuff is already there. But
yeah, it is. My wife shared with me a very interesting video. She follows, you know, a lot of the Disney, the guys who go to Disneyland like every day or every other day or something and film.
Those influencers.
Bricky and that sort of thing. And they had a really interesting video as to why Tron can't be brought to Disneyland. And I'm skeptical of that. I mean, certainly you can't do it now with the current footprint because what I didn't really realize is that Disneyland is so dependent on the water delivery system to make the park run, which is why, you know, Disney World was able to get away with getting rid of Rivers of America and all that, because they're independent of all that thing. You can't, Disneyland can't do that. So like she's saying, well, you know, we got that big building at the end of Tomorrowland. It's like, it's not where they used to have People Mover used to run through there, and there used to be something else there. I'm like, we're just wasting space there. That thing's the size of Space Mountain. But apparently it's all tied into the water delivery system. But here, you know what? I don't know if anybody cares, especially down in L.A. Nobody cares about Disneyland today because they're too busy celebrating.
Well, they are. They are. Look at you transitioning into, of course, the Los Angeles Dodgers. We are recording this on Sunday, Game 7 of the World Series.
I am the Messier to your Gretzky. I'm just assisting you. Here you go.
Fair enough. And I think we decided if the World Series went 7 games that we would drop this early. And so you'll be listening to this, hopefully day of, as we record this on Sunday, so that the thoughts are a little more fresh. And then you can just segue right in to your Monday with some bandwagon nerds as well, as we record that after. And here, I want to say this first. That was an epic World Series. It was a terrific World Series. You had 2 extra inning ball games, an 18 inning marathon of a game that goes in the favor of the Dodgers. And then of course the 11 inning game last night concludes on, as a result of a homer by, what was his name? The catcher for the Dodgers, like not one of the big ones.
I'll have to look. Wes Smith, was it Smith?
Well, there were two. There was the dramatic top of the ninth inning homer where the 9-hole hitter Rojas, Will Smith, that's right, he was getting jiggy with it, hits the clinching home run in the 10th or in the 11th. Rojas for the Dodgers on what I can only describe, and you weren't watching the game. We were texting back and forth. You were busy elsewhere. I was in a bar, in a sports bar, watching the game. I had gone out with some friends to catch some live music and knew that there was a sports bar across the street. So when I saw that the game was still going on, I went across the street to the sports bar and was watching the game. And the swing that Rojas put on that pitch that gets out of the park, I don't know how it gets out of the park. It's not the prettiest of swings in the world, but he hits that home run and I'm like, oh geez. And Dave immediately goes to, the Dodgers are cooked. And I'm like, well, maybe not, you know, like the Jays are cooked. And yeah. I'm like, well, maybe not. The Jays, you know, do have a chance. And they had some real chances to win that game. And I take umbrage a lot of times when people say, in baseball in particular, that a team choked. I think there was one that I do agree that the Jays lost their discipline in the bottom of the ninth, when you had a chance to put that game away and win your World Series. You have, I think it was, the bases were loaded and one out. And so a fly ball, anything that gets out of the infield is going to win this baseball game. And the Dodgers, they had started Ohtani. Ohtani got pulled in the third. They brought in Blake Snell. Blake Snell got pulled in the ninth with one out and the bases loaded to bring in Yamamoto. And what was frustrating to me is that you hear on and on about the discipline of the Blue Jays hitters. And we got a batter first pitch swinging in the against Yamamoto, and he lofts a lazy line drive, and then just bad base running, just bad ball base running, because you're so eager. Like the man on second base, you just don't fucking move if it's in the air at all, because your run means nothing, absolutely nothing. And that ball was too shallow for anybody to score. Like that was not going to be a sacrifice fly, because if he tries to go home, we are going to get thrown out of the plate. We're still going to get the double play. But to be that far off the second base as a runner that does not matter, that is bad ball. That is bad baseball. And that was the only moment where I was like, the Blue Jays fucked it up. In the 10th and the 11th, pitchers made pitches. And that's what those guys were paid to do. Now, I do think, and we'll get into this in a second. Well, actually, we'll get into that after you put your thoughts in. Like, that was the thing that was devastating me. The other, like, double plays and, the double play to end the game and all that. Like, that was a pitcher making pitches and getting the ground ball and getting it done. So kudos to them for making the pitches that they need to. But that's baseball.
And Toronto had so many chances to win this game and to win a championship. I mean, 3-0, you're up 4-2, you give up the homer to Muncy in the eighth. I get that whole thing. And then, Rojas how that gets out on that pitch, go figure. But
here's the thing. You got to tip your hat on that one. Like, you can't, like, You made a good pitch. That guy got a magic swing on it. Tip the cap. That's all you can do.
The bottom of the ninth was, I mean, we're at a haunted attraction last night. It was the last night it was going to be open. And it was, Auburn just fired Hugh Freeze, by the way.
We'll get to that. I knew that was coming. So
yeah, that just came through. But, you know, I was talking to, like, my nephew and I were watching, like, we're both watching online the ESPN app. He's watching the other one, and we saw the bases were loaded, one out, that sort of thing. I'm like, you know, this is tailor-made for, they can win this thing in multiple ways. When they got the out, I told him, I said, they had to have made a play at the plate, because with the bases loaded, you can't go anywhere else. You've got to go home, because that's the only play, because if you go anywhere else, great, you get the out, series over, championship won. That, and it's interesting. It's like, man, you know, if that, being able to do the force out there was a huge advantage to LA. Cause if he has to make the tag, he's not going to make the tag, and that's, right, and the run's going to score. So just being able to do the force out was massive. In the 11th inning, you know, you had Vlad gets the double right off the bat. And I've been wrestling with this ever since, Pat, and I was going to get your thoughts on this. Did they, I mean, strategically, I understand it's probably the right call.
Oh, I hate that they pulled Bichette. I hate that they pulled Bichette earlier in the game.
What I say it is, to do the sacrifice bunt after Guerrero gets the leadoff double, because, and I'm thinking, I get the strategy, but the way the game had been going, and I forget who did the sacrifice bunt, are you better off taking your chance that he's going to get a base hit to drive in the run rather than give away an out? Because that proved critical, because the next guy gets into the double play and here's the thing.
Yeah, I think no matter what you did in the situation after Guerrero hits the double, they were going to pitch around someone to set up the double play. And so, in theory, and I get what you're saying, like, maybe the double play, you know, the double play doesn't end the game if Guerrero's on second and it's runners on first and second, but it also is no guarantee.
It's also
no guarantee you're not going to get that out anyway.
Sure. I'm just thinking if you know, they get a base hit, either it's deep enough to score Guerrero from second, or worst case scenario, you've got first and third with nobody out. And then the double play.
But what I'm saying is if you don't square around to bunt, you don't square around to move the batter over, they're going to walk him anyway. Like, they're going to walk him anyway. You're going to pitch around him to set up the double play. So I see it from the manager's standpoint of, you know what, we're gonna move that runner over. That puts us in an opportunity for a fly ball.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is, as a hitter, you've got to try and get it up and loft it out of the outfield. Unfortunately for him, again, the pitch was made and it was a ground ball, and Yamamoto is your World Series MVP and rightfully should be. Like, that dude was dominant. Like, he was unhittable, and they made
six and seven were all him.
Right.
What was it? Game six was a complete game, or damn near.
Game three was a complete game. Game six, right, he pitched seven.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah. And we made the comment. You made the comment when the series started, that Dodgers rotation.
Well, and that's the thing.
Toronto had to get to the bullpen, and in game seven, there was no bullpen. It's your starting rotation, and you saw what happened.
And this is the problem, and why I think that in 2027, there will be a lockout, because this is too far gone in favor of the players and franchises that are obscenely bloated with cash. Because the Dodgers, in game seven, just rattling these salaries off, no reason. $750 million pitcher, $182 million starting pitcher, $136.5 million starting pitcher, and a $325 million pitcher, all pitched in the World Series to win the game. This is not the spirit of competition. Like, it's in the spirit of competition in the sense that them's the rules and they can do it. But what are we actually doing here as a sport? And it's not a sport. And I'm not saying that a bloated payroll is going to win you a World Series, because the New York Mets showed that it can't. The Los Angeles Dodgers are an extraordinarily well-run organization, but they have the inside track advantage of, you don't have to have the best farm system. You don't have to have the best coaching staff. And again, Dave Roberts, terrific manager. Not saying he's not. But when you can throw cash, and in Ohtani's case, throw cash at him in a way that's even more egregious because he makes $1 million a season until after he's over. Like, how the fuck is that right? How the fuck is that right? How is that fair? And how is it good for the fans? Like, I saw somebody today on social media trying to argue that the way that the Dodgers spent money to get those pitchers was good for baseball. And I firmly disagree. And my problem here, and this is the problem with sports. Yes, we do like winners and we like people that bring in money, but we also get tired of it. And the Los Angeles Dodgers have been in 13 consecutive postseasons and now have been in back-to-back World Series wins. Like, it's boring. It's not good for the sport. Like, I'm interested to see what the ratings are, because it's probably going to prove me wrong. The ratings are probably going to be great for the viewership of the World Series.
I think they're way high.
But I think that's mostly out of interest in Toronto knocking them off. And that's going to be the argument everybody says, well, everybody wants to see David knock off Goliath. The problem is that Goliath doesn't usually get knocked off in these scenarios. And let's not act like the Toronto Blue Jays were penny pinchers. Like their payroll wasn't as massive as the Dodgers, but we looked them up. Like, back at the beginning of the series, the teams that spent the most money in the offseason, with very few exceptions, were in the playoffs. And that is, it's not a competitive balance. And as much as people want to rag on the NFL and the Kansas City Chiefs, who, by the way, in decline, even though they've looked good the last couple of weeks, and as we've said, you know, they're the team to beat until they're not, but there's parity. Parity exists to a degree in these other sports that have a salary cap and needs to have something more significant when you blow that salary cut. Because that luxury tax is a joke. Clearly, it's a joke.
It is.
And small market teams can't survive. Like, there's no point. Why would you watch the Pittsburgh Pirates play fucking baseball when they're never going to spend because they can't, like the Los Angeles Dodgers? That it all goes back to Moneyball. It's terrible.
I mean, people, no, you're right. I mean, I think for when it happens once a decade, you get a team like the Royals a few years ago, right? When they kind of came out of nowhere and became really good for 2 or 3 years there. Now they're back to mediocre. I mean, small market team, not a big payroll, caught the right kind of talent at the right time. You know, but that's even like when the Nationals won the World Championship in 2019, that was no small payroll team. That team was fucking loaded. Right. And you know, yeah, they beat the Dodgers, who are equally loaded, but sometimes talent wills out and you get a few breaks here and there. But yeah, you're right. This baseball's horribly broken because nobody wants to see, except the people in New York and LA, Yankees Dodgers every year. And that's right. What was great about this World Series is you got somebody new, you got new blood, you got the Toronto Blue Jays. And let's be honest, everything you're saying about the Dodgers is true, but there's a really strong argument that Toronto should have won this World Series despite all that, and they just didn't.
And again, my thing is it's not like Toronto wasn't spending money. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, we can sit here and be like, oh, it wasn't like the Little Sisters of the Poor rising up against the Dodgers.
Right.
I look at baseball, like, it is not intriguing to me to see it's not that it's not intriguing. I struggle to see a team in the American League or National League Central making a run, a deep playoff run, seriously, unless your farm talent that you still have under control before they go into their arbitration years and become unrestricted, you know, free agents. Until that happens, like, you get what Milwaukee has right now. Their young pitching talent is extraordinary. They've got enough veterans that can hit, and that works. It's just the other side of it, and it is gross. It feels gross, and it's no fun. It's just no fun.
Maybe Detroit, you know, they kind of fell off at the end of the year and then kind of got it back going in the playoffs, but not enough. But yeah, you're right. I did want to say one thing about Dave Roberts, and I'm no Dodger fan, even though I live out here, but you got to give this guy credit. He's caught a lot of shit for many years when the Dodgers were choking in the playoffs against teams like the Nationals, against other teams. And you look at the job he's done the last 2 years, he's got all the tools and all the talent, but you still got to manage it. And he did a great job of that.
I want to reiterate that you had a starting rotation of four number ones and a number three starter, because Clayton Kershaw is old, and you know, kudos to Clayton Kershaw for going out a winner. He's a Hall of Fame pitcher, and he's gonna be a Hall of Fame pitcher. I'm just disgusted with it all. Like, I just am tired of it all. It's horrible.
And I want to ask you before we move on to college football, and you and I were texting about it last night, and this question has been come up several times. Was this the greatest World Series of all time?
I don't think so. I don't think so because, and I'll say, I think that you had one of the greatest World Series teams ever built of all time that was able. And I'm not saying that this wasn't an epic series or the great, you know, it wasn't a terrific series. 86, the 86 series between the Red Sox and the Mets, between Buckner's legs. Because here's the thing about this series that other World Series have, and you said 91, and the reason those series fall into greatest series of all time is, like, I don't think anybody's going to remember anything special about this series after it's done other than it went seven and the Dodgers pitching was great. What happened in 86 that everybody remembers?
The moment of the ball going to Buckner's legs.
Game six. Behind the bag. The Red Sox on the verge of breaking a curse. Bill Buckner, one of the most sound defensive infielders of all time. Bad knees, couldn't get down to field the grounder. And it then leads to a loss in game seven as the Mets tear it up. 91. What's the big moment out of 91?
Multiple. But I mean, Kirby Puckett's homer in game six, and we'll see you tomorrow night. And then game seven goes 10 innings with no score. And there were so many games in that series that were just titanic epic struggles between these two upstart teams that came out of nowhere.
The Florida Marlins beating the New York Yankees in 2000, what was that?
2003?
Luis Gonzalez.
The Diamondbacks.
Sorry, not the Marlins. The Diamondbacks.
That's 2001. That was a great series. In the shadow of September 11th as well.
Right.
So that had extra meaning.
There's just, and that's the thing, is there were performances that were iconic, but for me, a World Series is about iconic moments. Even my favorite World Series of all time, which I do not think is one of the greatest World Series of all time, because it had one epic game, and David Freese and Lance Berkman saving the Cardinals from elimination on their last strike with two outs in back-to-back innings to beat the Texas Rangers is more memorable.
What's a series that doesn't get hardly any attention is the Cardinals and the Brewers. I think that was what, like 82? Doesn't that go seven games?
It goes seven games. Harvey's Wallbangers versus Whitey Ball, first year that Whitey Herzog's style play.
And is it 87 that the Cardinals and Twins go the full distance and the Twins get their first championship?
Neither team could win in the other team's stadium. And the Twins had home field, so every game traded off.
Everybody talks about 75, but honestly, Pat, I was too young to remember that one. I know that's hard for you to believe.
I know.
But I was too
young. What is also hard for us to believe is we need to take a commercial break. We are running way up against it for time. And so we're going to take our commercial break. I wouldn't want our friend PC Tunney to not be able to talk about The Witcher, you know, any later than he has to. So we got to make sure that we do that. So we are going to come right back, and we're going to talk about yet another firing in college football, because that's what we do now. So stay tuned for that. You're listening to the Four Quarters Podcast here on the ChairShot Radio Network, part of thechairshot.com.
Why should you visit thechairshot.com? Thechairshot.com is your home for hard-hitting reviews, news, opinion, and analysis with attitude. Why? Because you're smarter than the average fan. Thechairshot.com. Always use your head.
Welcome back, everyone, into the Four Corners Podcast here on the ChairShot Radio Network, a part of thechairshot.com, where we remind you to always use your head. Head over to prowrestlingtees.com/ChairShot for all of your ChairShot swag needs. David Ungar, Patrick O'Dowd here. We're going to do a quick final segment. We ran a little over time, talked about the World Series and everything that's wrong with it, or at least wrong with Major League Baseball. The series itself was fine. It was a great series. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed watching it. But it is another Sunday afternoon here on the East Coast, and another college football firing. This is one we talked about weeks ago when we were talking about hot seat coaches. This week, hot seat favorite Hugh Freeze out at Auburn after a very disappointing season. They were ranked as high as, I want to say, like fifth or sixth, and just trash. They're like a 3-5 team or something, like 3-6 or something like that. It's not going well there. It's not working. The team looked listless, didn't look like it was there to play, and it showed. And this is the thing about the college football playoff that I think is really, really interesting, and I think actually opens up the conversation for keeping it at 12 teams and not expanding it any further. And that is the expectation of a program. Because once upon a time, and I've heard this, this is not a new concept, by the way. Like, I am not coming up with this on my own. I've heard multiple other podcasts and journalists talk about this. So while I say this, this is not an original idea by me, but it is one that I think makes a lot of sense. And I'll get your thought on it too, Dave. When the college football playoff was four teams, if you were a program like an LSU or an Auburn or a Clemson, which Dabo, come on, bro, you lost to fucking Duke in overtime. And Duke's good, but again, another team had high expectations. Cade Klubnik looking awful. The idea of missing the college football playoff but still going to a good bowl was enough for the Penn States, the LSUs, the Auburns in the world, because only four teams get to get in. And you could decry however you wanted to decry the system itself. With expansion, expectations for those programs have changed. And LSU is my favorite, like, just shit show right now, because my God, like, the governor is going to pick the new athletic, because they fired everybody at LSU. Like, the athletic director.
We didn't
out.
Even talk about Brian Kelly. Brian getting Kelly. Fired. Brian that was Kelly got week, fired. Right?
Yeah. That was last week. That was last week.
Was it? Well,
so here's the thing: is now those schools, when you see, hey, there's 12 teams and we're in the SEC, and people are talking about five SEC teams getting in, those schools are like, we're one of those teams. And so what happens is that the second you don't make that playoff, we are firing the coach. And that's the world we have right now in college football, is that if you are in one of these programs, like, we're gonna let the coach go because we can't. You know what I mean?
I'm just listening to you. I'm just thinking to myself, that's the tweet.
Like suddenly, because, and it's an out of whack way of thinking, and this is why I love being a fan of the team that I am. Like, you know, I get to be happy that Illinois made itself bowl eligible in back-to-back seasons for the first time since the early 2000s. Since the Ron Zook era of Illinois? Like, it's been a long time. And I like where Brett Bielema has gotten the team to where its ceiling seems to be expectation is that you will make a bowl, because we haven't had that. In Illinois. And it was funny, when Illinois lost to Indiana, Tunney was like, I've just seen it with Brett Bielema, and, you know, there's a ceiling there. And I'm like, we've never had that ceiling at Illinois, like, not since the 80s. So I want that ceiling right now. And, you know, if Brett Bielema retires and whatever, like, I wish we'd hit the home run that Kurt Cignetti is, but because Indiana, like, they have changed their outlook on football. But yeah, sure. Right now, if you are in a upper half SEC program, if you are in an upper half Big Ten program, traditional power, like Michigan, you best keep winning if you want to keep your job. Penn State, you best keep winning if you want to keep your job, because who knows who Penn State's going to be able to get. We'll see. Yeah. But they haven't been the same. Like, James Franklin was a consistently 9-10 win coach. He was a good football coach, but he never got Penn State there. And in that one, at least, I was like, okay, this one feels like Penn State is done. A mutual parting of ways is necessary, because, like, the team looked like it had quit after losing to Oregon. This, with Auburn, the team had quit, and Hugh Freeze wasn't working. And Hugh Freeze is, in my opinion, one of the biggest fraud coaches in college football. Like, he tends to rest on the success of his predecessor and then can't recruit.
Yeah.
And I know we're up against it, so I won't. As our friend Ray Cash would say, bloviate too much about this. But I think with the college football playoff being what it is, you know, at 12 teams right now, I get what you're saying. Like, our expectations now, it's like, hey, with all this extra, you know, all these other teams that might be able to make it in there, if you're not yielding immediate results, like these programs are going to just be more inclined to just, you know, make these kind of changes, like midseason coaching change, which you hardly ever saw. How many have we seen this year? You know, it's because like you got that expectation that's just out there now. It's like, look, there's 12 openings on this thing. If you're in a, like you're saying, if you're in a power conference, like the big whatever it is, and the SEC, and the you're Big not 10. At least in the conference, the Big Ten, I know.
The Big 18.
Feels so the Big 18. The Big Ten feels disingenuous. But no, but you're right. If you're in one of these big power conferences, like, you know, even the ACC, you know, now they're executing more patience with Dabo than I would think. But I mean, they are going to be much more inclined to make a dramatic, like we talk about hockey, those midseason coaching changes, which sometimes yield great results. Here, it's just like, hey, we're not going to make the playoff. Let's move on and do something different.
I do want to share one text that Tony sent me earlier in the week. I want to ask you what you think. Is there a college football program that could lure John Gruden to coach? And I think this is a terrible idea, by the way, because I think that we are seeing that pro coaches are not good college football coaches. Bill Belichick, failure. Lovie Smith, failure. Deion Sanders, while not a pro football coach, takes a pro mentality. Failure. I don't think John Gruden fits, but I would say if Florida doesn't get their top guy, that would be my best bet.
He would make more sense in Florida. With his baggage, do you dare put him at Penn State with all the issues that they've had historically?
No.
Horrible decision. Florida may not be bad because of his connection with Tampa and because people in Florida were going to look at him a lot differently than someplace else. But yeah, he's been out of the game for how many years now?
And yeah, he's just been, I think he's content broadcasting.
I would not do it because I also agree with you. There are very few pro coaches making that transition.
I also wonder if there is anybody out there that could pull either Nick Saban or Urban Meyer out of retirement to coach. You know, would Urban go back to
Nick's
Florida?
Nick's having too much fun with the Pat McAfee
Probably.
Show and all that stuff.
He might be, but it's those are the splashy. But here's the thing: is if you're an AD, you got to call him. You got to at least make him say no.
Absolutely. You got to. Yeah, exactly. You put the call out there. Is Kiffin the only really coach who went from pro to college that's had any sort of success?
Right. Lane Kiffin, at Ole Miss. And I don't think he's going anywhere. I think he knows.
It wasn't immediate success. He had to go through a lot of growing pains to acclimate to the college game.
Lane Kiffin was also younger. So I think that's made a big difference. So we'll see.
And his dad knows a little something about defense too. So just throwing that out there.
But Ole Miss does not. So, all right, we have to go. We are running over. I already texted Tony to let him know we were running a little over. So we're going to jump out of here. Before we do though, Dave, tell us where people can find you on the socials and on the Chairshot Radio Network.
Yeah, you can find me on X and Blue Sky at Attitude Ag. That is at Attitude AGG, Facebook.com/Attitude of Aggression and at Attitude of Aggression, all one word, over on Instagram and Threads.
Cool. And you can catch me on the socials at Wrestling Realist. That is at WRESTLNGREALIST. You can catch me every Monday, Tuesday, and many Wednesdays on the Chairshot Radio Network. Mondays, talking nerdy stuff with David PC Tunney. Usually Tuesdays, talking sports with David Ungar. And Wednesdays, talking wrestling with Craig DeMarco when we feel like it or when he's not busy trying to run a show that booked Samoa Joe for the first time in 10 years on the Indies. I get it. I get why he canceled this week. So just a lot going on with him. Craig, looking forward to hearing how that show goes in a couple weeks. So, all right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of Four Corners Podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will see you next week here on the Chairshot Radio Network, part of the Chairshot.com.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer, first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.